Gradually, the plane over which they travelled altered in character. Amongst the fine desert grasses there appeared scraggly little scrubs, not as high as Santan's knee, and once Oa stopped and pointed ahead at a tall, ghostly shape that crossed with a high-stepping trot ahead of them in the night, a dark body fringed with a fluffy white, and only as it disappeared into the shadows did Santan realize that it was a wild ostrich. At dawn, Oa spread the chemsbok hide as a sun shelter, and they waited out the day. At sunset, they drank the last drops of water from the egg bottles, and the San were quiet and serious as they set out again. Without water, death was only hours away. At dawn, instead of going into camp immediately, Oa stood for a long time examining the sky, and then he ranged in a half-circle ahead of their track, like a gun dog quartering for the bird, lifting his head, turning it slowly from side to side, his nostrils sucking at the air.
"What is Oa doing?" Santan asked.
"Smell," Hani snuffled to show her.
"Smell water."
Santan was incredulous.
"No smell water, Hani."
"Yes, yes, wait, you see."
Oa reached a decision.
"Come,"
he beckoned, and the women snatched up their satchels and hurried after him. Within an hour, Santan realized that if Oa was mistaken, then she was dead. The egg bottles were empty. The heat and the sun were sucking the moisture out of her, and she would be finished before the real burning heat of noon fell upon them. Oa broke into a full run. The gait that the San called the horns, the run of the hunter when he sees the horns of his quarry on the skyline ahead, and the women under their burdens could not try to match him. An hour later, they made out his tiny form far ahead, and when they at last came up with him, he smiled a broad welcome, and with a sweep of his arm announced grandly,
"Oa has led you unerringly to the sipwells of the elephant with one tusk."
The origins of the name were lost far back in the oral history of the San. Oa swaggered shamelessly as he led them down the gentle slope of the riverbed. It was a wide watercourse, but Santan saw immediately that it was completely dry, filled with loose sand, as loose and friable as that of the dune country, and she felt her spirits drop sharply as she looked about her. The winding serpentine watercourse was about 100 paces wide, cutting through the gravel beds of the plain, and although there was no water, both banks were dark with much denser plant growth than the arid flats beyond. The scrub was almost waist-high, with an occasional dull green bush rising above the rest. The San were chattering brightly, and Hani followed closely behind her husband as he strutted about importantly in the sand of the riverbed. Santan sank down, picked up a handful of the bright orange-coloured sand, and let it trickle through her fingers disconsolately. Then, for the first time, she noticed that the riverbed was wildly trampled by the hooves of chemsbok, and that in places the sand had been heaped as though children had been digging sand castles. Oa was now examining one of these piles critically, and Santan dragged herself up and went to see what he had found. The chemsbok must have been digging in the riverbed, but sand had trickled back into the hole, almost filling it. Oa nodded sagely, and he turned to Hani.
"This is a good place. Here we will make our sip well. Take the child and show her how to build a shelter."
Santan was so thirsty and heat-lashed that she felt dizzy and sick, but she slipped off the strap of her bag and wearily climbed the riverbank after Hani to help her cut whippy saplings and thorny branches from the scrub. In the riverbed they quickly erected 2 rudimentary shelters, sticking the saplings into the sand in a circle, bending them over to meet on top, and roofing one of them with branches and the other with the stiff, stinking Gemsbok skin. They were the most primitive of shelters, without sides and floored with river sand, but Santan flopped gratefully into the shade and watched Owa. Firstly, he removed the poisoned heads from his arrows, handling them with elaborate care, for a single scratch would be fatal. He wrapped each arrowhead in a scrap of raw hide and packed them into one of the pouches on his belt. Then he began to fit the reed arrows together, sealing the joints with a ball of acacia gum, until he had a single length of hollow reeds longer than he was tall.
"Help me, little flower of my life,"
he sweetened honey blatantly, and with their hands they began to dig together in the sand. To prevent the sand running back into the hole, they made it funnel-shaped, wide at the top and gradually narrowing until Owa's head and the shoulders disappeared into it. And at last he started throwing up handfuls of darker, damp sand. Deeper still he dug, until Hani had to hold him by the ankles while his entire body was jammed in the hole. At last, in response to muffled cries from the depths, she passed the long, hollow reed down to him. Upside down in the well, Owa placed the open end of the reed carefully and then fitted a filter of twigs and leaves around the open end of it to prevent it becoming clogged. With both women hauling on his ankles, they drew him out of the narrow well and he emerged coated with orange sand. Hani had to clean out his ears and brush it from the combs of his grey hair and from his eyelashes. Carefully, a handful at a time, Owa refilled the well, leaving the filter and the reed undisturbed, and when he was finished, he patted the sand down firmly, leaving a short length of the end of the reed pipe sticking out above the surface. While Owa put the finishing touches to his well, Hani chose a green twig, stripped off the horns and peeled it. Then she helped Santan unplug the egg bottles and set them out in a neat row beside the well. Owa stretched himself out, belly down on the sand, and placed his lips over the end of the reed tube. Hani squatted beside him attentively, the row of egg bottles within reach, and the peeled green twig in her hand.
"I am ready, hunter of my heart," she told him, and Owa began to suck.
From under her shelter, Santan watched as Owa turned himself into a human bellows. His chest swelled and subsided, seeming to double in size with each hissing intake of air, and then Santan could sense the impediment of a heavy load in the tube. Owa's eyes closed tightly, disappearing behind a network of baggy wrinkles, and his face darkened with effort to the colour of toffee. His body pumped and pulsated. He swelled like a bullfrog and shrank and swelled again, straining to draw a heavy weight up the long, thin reed tube. Suddenly he made a mewing sound in his throat without breaking the rhythm of his powerful suctions, and Hani leaned forward and gently fitted the peeled twig into the corner of his mouth. A diamond-bright drop of water bubbled out between Owa's lips and slid down the twig. It quivered on the tip for an instant and then dropped into the egg bottle that Hani held below it.
"Good water, singer of my soul," Hani encouraged him. "Good sweet water."
And the flow from the old man's mouth became a steady silver dribble as he sucked it and let it run on the exhale. The effort required was enormous, for Owa was lifting the water over 6 feet, and Santan watched in awe as he filled one egg bottle, then another, and still a third, without a pause. Hani squatted over him, tending him, encouraging him, adjusting the twig and the bottles, cooing to him softly. And suddenly Santan was struck with a strange feeling of empathy for this pair of little old people. She realized how they had been forged by joy and tragedy and unremitting hardship into a union so fast and strong that they were almost a single entity. She saw how the hard years had gifted them with humor and sensitivity, and simple wisdom and fortitude, but most of all, with love, and she envied them without rancor.
If only, she thought, if only I could be bound to another human being as these two are bound to each other.
And in that moment she realized that she had come to love them. At last, Owa rolled away from the tube and lay gasping and panting and shaking in the sand, like a marathon runner when the race is run, and Hani brought one of the egg bottles to San Tan.
Drink, Nam child.
She offered it to San Tan. Almost reluctantly, achingly aware of the effort that had gone into reaping such priceless drop, San Tan drank. She drank sparingly, piously, and then handed the bottle back.
Good water, honey, she said.
Though it was brackish and mingled with the old man's saliva, San Tan now understood completely that the San definition of good water was any fluid which would sustain life in the desert. She rose and went to see where Owa lay in the sand.
Good water, Owa.
She knelt beside him, and she saw how the effort had drained him, but he grinned up at her and bobbed his head, still too tired to rise.
Good water, Nam child, he agreed.
San Tan unfastened the lanyard from around her waist and held the knife in both hands. It had saved her life already. It might do so again in the hard days ahead, if she kept it.
Take, Owa,
she offered it to him.
Knife for you, Owa.
He stared at the knife, and the dark, blood-suffused tones of his wrinkled face paled, and a great devastation seemed to empty all expression from his eyes.
Take, Owa, San Tan urged him. It is too much,
he whispered, staring at the knife with stricken eyes. It was a gift without price. San Tan reached out, took his wrist, and turned his hand upwards. She placed the knife in his hand and folded his fingers over it. Sitting in the harsh sunlight with the knife in his hand, Owa's chest heaved as powerfully as it had as he drew water from the sip well, and a tear welled out of the corner of one eye and ran down the deep groove alongside his nose.
Why are you weeping, you silly old man?
Hani demanded.
I weep for joy of this gift.
Owa tried to maintain dignity, but his voice choked.
That is a stupid reason to weep,
Hani told him, and twinkled mischievously as she covered her laughter with one slim, graceful little hand.